This is interviewing Martin Schmidt on 18th August 75 at the AAS meeting at San Diego. So when did you first come into contact with radio astronomy?
I think it must have been late 1953 or early 1954. After I had entered graduate school at Leiden, in 1949, Ort, the director, asked me to go to Kenya to do observations for with Van Herk to determine declinations of stars from a mountaintop on the equator, the Earth equator. So I got my study got a bit delayed because I only came back in December 1951, and in the meantime, of course, all the excitement of the discovery of the 21 centimeter line had happened,
right,
with all three places having been involved, isn't that right? Ewing at Harvard,
right,
and the Dutch and the Australians all in a rather short time span, which I think was the middle of 51. I was completely out of that. I mean, I was in Kenya in the woods. And when I came back, all that had happened, but I had to resume my graduate studies. So I'm sure I took classes for the next 2 years or so. And toward the end of 53, I think I got involved in radio astronomy, which was to be the second approximation, the second go at spiral structure.
Right.
The first one had been done by Oort and van der Hulst and Muller or so, where the external, that is to the sun, spiral structure had been investigated and uncovered for the first time. And this was to be a second go-around where I was to take the interior part of the galaxy within the solar distance, and of course from the northern hemisphere, and where Gert Westerhout was to take the external part of the galaxy outside the solar distance. And
In neutral hydrogen?
In neutral hydrogen, all at 21 centimeters.
And I assume that it was Professor Oort that was choreographing all of this.
This was certainly, he had a grand plan that he didn't necessarily talk that much about, but we were part of that, of course,
right,
at the time already. And so certainly in 1954, I went up twice, I'm sure, in the beginning and later in that year, for a 14-day or 3-week runs with a Kotwijk dish, which had to be moved by hand every 2.5 minutes, both in both in azimuth and altitude, on the basis of pre-computed tables. I remember that one got very good at reading a book or just studying for about 2 minutes 20 seconds, then to look up at the clock to confirm that yes, it was about time to change things, and then to change the two, you know, from inside the observing cabin.
And these predictions, did they come from did you have a Reichenkammer at
We had a Reichenkammer
Leiden
there
also?
The human computers,
right,
not machine computers, but the human computers had all prepared that. It was quite a lot of work, really. Anyhow, I remember one of the things I may have started there was to, instead of doing line profiles, which would be at a particular position at given longitude and latitude, and then as a function of frequency,
right,
that I started to do cross sections across the Milky Way, more or less in latitude, at a given longitude, more or less, and certainly a given radio velocity or frequency, because the difficulty, of course, of the detection and the disentangling of spiral structure in the interior part of the galaxy is that there are two points along the line of sight,
right,
at equal galactocentric distance, where at least in the plane the two contributions from the two points cannot be separated out. It is only as a function of latitude that you might hope to do that, because
right,
the near contribution has a wider distribution in latitude.
So that was your idea, to try to
and
use that?
The idea was therefore to do a rather conscious effort to try and get the cross sections perpendicular to the plane with the highest possible accuracy. And the way we did that was by making at a given position in the Milky Way at longitude zero, we would sort of make a tracing, just let the antenna stand there, not move it at all in azimuth or altitude, and because of the geometry of things, the thing went across at an angle of about 30 degrees from what you wanted. In other words,
60 degrees
to the plane, which was a pretty good cross-section. And it was a great attraction, of course, to that kind of observing, because you had nothing to do. Right. You know, you really could sort of let it go for an hour or two, and then you would move it again ahead of the Milky Way, and you'd make another cross-section.
And you picked the peak hydrogen velocity, I suppose?
And I picked velocities all along the entire profile that went with that particular position in the galaxy, okay. So I could, as a function of velocity, try to do the this engaging of the two contributions. And one hoped essentially, and in some cases that was really also observed, ideally one would like to see a broad profile and then sort of near the middle, where the peak was about to appear, a sharper, narrower peak. That was the far contribution, and the rest was a nearby one. But of course at radio velocities and frequencies where the distance ratio between the two points was not expected to be so large, say a factor of 2.5 or so, it was rather more difficult to separate it out. But I did succeed nonetheless in doing a reasonable separation. And I remember that much of the reduction, which of course again was done by hand, much of it by myself, and of course with extensive help again from people, from computers. I remember that at the final phase of the whole project, that the result essentially came in positions all over the central part of the galaxy, of course only the northern hemisphere, for different radio velocities or frequencies, distances of course, the two contributions separated out, mm-hmm. nearby and far, and at each of them an intensity or a hydrogen density was finally computed. And I remember that finally, I think it must have been in the summer of probably 55, sometime in August, it was very hot on a Tuesday evening or so, I had finally a list of 808 points like that with the position in the galaxy.
So you could plot it up.
Yeah, and then I could plot it up. And that was really, really quite exciting, because I plotted on a fairly large scale. I plotted all these 808 points and wrote in the density, and then started drawing just from nothing. Started to draw ISO density contours, and by gosh, they
made some structure.
You saw structure, and you could follow things around half or one quarter of the galaxy or so, around 180 or perhaps 90 or 100 degrees. It was really very exciting, especially to realize you looked at distances in the galaxy that of course were very large, considering what you can do optically.
Right,
you know,
right.
You looked at things 10, 15 kiloparsecs.
Well, this was completely unknown what was coming
on. Yeah, right. Yeah. And in the interior part, never been seen or disentangled yet. So that was really very interesting.
Now, what was your feeling as to the reality of these features? So
I thought that they were real. I thought that they were real. And it's interesting, of course, that since that time that things have not changed an awful lot yet. The interpretation, of course, of these ISO density, these contour maps, has changed somewhat. Like Burton has shown, if you have a velocity perturbation rather than a density perturbation, by Jove, you can almost do it with a continuum, with a uniform distribution. But nonetheless, something is happening that does show a circular or a large-ish scale spiral structure, and that's probably the main thing.
Right.
So that was sort of interesting. Around the same time, I was working on a thesis topic, which was to be the mass distribution in the galaxy, which for which there was a good incentive at that time, namely, since you can from 21 centimeter only get the rotation curve out to the solar distance, the main purpose of the exercise was to get the rotation curve outside the sun, essentially by putting together a mass model that fitted well inside the solar distance, and then to extrapolate that mass model itself by what seemed to be a reasonable distribution of matter, and then to compute the rotation curve in the outer parts of the galaxy on the basis of that.
Well, wasn't this inner rotation curve also quite new? I mean,
that was fairly new, and was in fact, I think that the first publication of it was only in 1958. No, that sounds strange. 54, it must have been Quay, Westhout, and Müller. And that, of course, it was in itself was very exciting to see that happen, because all we'd known until that time had been A and B, isn't that right?
The differential properties
in the sun's neighborhood, and no other information. It did become feasible. You're quite right. It did become feasible at that moment to come up with a mass model that was fairly detailed, because the rotation curve for the first time was available fairly detailed, rather than just only an overall outline with a local slope that was perhaps fairly good due to an A and B. But we now had much more detail. Until that time, Oort had used units of mass of matter in his models that were sort of homogeneous ellipsoids of rotation, and at that time I extended this into the use of inhomogeneous ellipsoids, essentially by taking an infinite number of his ellipsoids of different size and superimposing them all together. And it turned out that the formulation, the mathematical formulation of these things turned out to be fairly simple and fairly straightforward and tractable. So it was actually not more difficult to work with these inhomogeneous spheroids than it was to work with the old homogeneous ones. And that gave nice smooth results for the models and so on, rather than what you would get in these in this finite number of homogeneous ellipsoids. You would of course get sharp breaks in your rotation curve, density distribution and so on. So,
when were you working on this now?
That was all at the same time. That also started late 53, I think.
Oh, I see. And, simultaneously.
And then 54, and then I think it was all completed in early 56, I think, in March 56, when I got my degree on May or so. So those two things sort of went on in parallel fashion.
So if it hadn't been such so mathematically tractable, then it probably would have been impossible at that stage to...
Well, in that case, one would have worked with these homogeneous things, which of course
you
are
would have
tractable,
fallen back
but
on
it's,
that,
it's somewhat think. It's somewhat messy, it's not so elegant, but it worked out very well. And so there was sort of an interchange. I mean, for the working out of the spiral structure in the interior parts, I used the results that had already been obtained for the endpoints of the profiles in the interior part, rotation curve, from Quay, Westhout, and Müller. And in return, as it were, I constructed galactic models, which Westerhout then needed in order to, for his outer spiral structure studies, to convert angle of velocities that he of course got from the observations into distances to the sun. So we worked quite closely together all the time.
So you got your degree then in 56, you said?
I got my degree in 56, and then I got a Carnegie Fellowship at Mount Wilson, Pasadena. And during the 2 years that I was there, almost 2 years, I did some observational work on galactic clusters, some of which didn't work out too well. And I also became interested in star formation. And in the consequences of star formation, gas being used up, and therefore as a function of time, there being less and less gas in the galaxy, the gas mass decreasing, the star mass increasing.
Was this, you think, motivated by working with all this gas, essentially?
It was motivated essentially by the 21-centimeter stuff, although it really got quite a boost from Sidney Vandenberg, whom I met in the middle of 57 at an AES meeting at Harvard, and who asked me about the Dutch results on all this work on the galaxy, and who became then suddenly very interested in the fact that the total gas mass in our neighborhood is only of the order of 10%. It means that much of the activity in terms of star formation or in the conversion of gas into stars, effect is already behind us.
Right.
So he started to work on that and put up a sort of initial formulation, and when I saw that, I liked part of it, and I did not like another part of it, so I started to work on some of it myself, and got rather involved in that for the next few years.
Did you know at all about the Harvard? They were just going then with observations of stellar clusters. Cauchy Menon did some, and...
Yes, around that time, that was happening there, I think, yes.
Did that influence you at all?
No. No, it was just the overall distribution of gas throughout the galaxy, which, by the way, didn't only show that, of course, over here, that the percentage was fairly low in mass of gas, only 10%, but also that if you go to the interior part of the galaxy here, in our galaxy, that that the gas density remains more or less constant, while models, of course, showed very clearly that the total mass density increases quite steeply. So the fractional contribution by the gas becomes less and less when you go to the interior parts of the galaxy.
Right, and that was first recognized in our own galaxy before any external galaxies were done.
That's correct. That followed essentially from the work on the spiral structure and so on. And that gave rise essentially in 1957 or 58, 59 to the idea that I expressed at that time that star formation might go as a power of the gas density, which is more than one. In which case things sort of go that way. But of course these days, as we've heard in the meeting this morning, one can now probably think more physical, because that was not a physical law, it was just a feeling that
you just
it might
wanted
go
some
that way.
Strong independence.
That's right. But as we now hear, it may have to do with the crossing of a spiral wave through a neighborhood, which of course is much more effective, mm-hmm. because how do you get it to condense otherwise anyhow, you know?
Right. Were you aware when you were at Palomar of the radio work going on there, the very beginnings of it? In fact, the first H1 observations were done in the Palomar Mountain itself, weren't they?
Yeah, that's right.
Were you involved in that at all?
No, there was a 30-foot antenna that was on Palomar as a first while Bolton was here. But then, of course, the Owens Valley Radio Observatory had already been started, and it was, I think, in the around 55 or so, 56. No, it's rather later. Well, I shouldn't talk about the early days of Owens Valley.
Well, I have talked about Gordon's.
But of course, the interesting work that was going on at that time was done by Matthews and Maltby and Moffat when they found a double structure of many of the radio sources. And that followed the work at Jodl Bank, where Jensen had shown that Cygnus A was double. Now, I did not do anything really active in radio astronomy during that first visit here in 1950, from 56 to 58. I worked mostly with the optical astronomers, had contact with Bolton and Matthews and so on, but wasn't active in radio astronomy. And then when I came back late 59 to take up a position at Caltech, it took about a year or so, year and a half, at the time when Minkowski had retired. Minkowski retired in June 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And just in his last run in May 1960, he had been able to get 3C295 with a redshift of 46%, which until very recently
right.
still was the record, a remarkable achievement of his. And well, when Minkowski retired, it was clear that the radio astronomers were doing such interesting work and identifying these elliptical galaxies that that work ought to go on in terms of the redshifts that the radio astronomers very badly needed. And while at one time some of us sat together and felt that each of us could once in a while take one of these galaxies, that was probably not so practical, and I got somewhat more interested, and together with Matthews, who did the at that time, and it was 1961 about, the position and identification work, I started to fairly regularly from 61 onward to observe radio galaxies to, to get their redshifts. And it was sort of pleasant work and so on.
So you, I wanted to ask you, so you felt then that you were sort of carrying on in Minkowski. If no one did it, then it would really lag.
Right, because it was clear that it was very interesting. The redshifts were very badly needed. When I took over from Minkowski, I think that only redshifts of only 10 or 15 radio galaxies were only known, and almost all of those were very bright. You know, like Centaurus A and Cygnus A and NGC, well, M87 and so on. And I started on the very much fainter galaxies then, which was a sort of observational challenge, which turned out to be feasible. I found that most of those faint ones actually did show emission lines that were quite strong. And so it was interesting work, and it was doable, and I made it my program.
Let me ask you about the relationship between the optical astronomers and radio astronomy. It's been my impression that there were very few in the 50s who properly appreciated what radio astronomy was developing into.
Yeah.
And do you have any opinions as to why that was?
No, well, perhaps yes. It was mostly, I think, a lack of communication. Well, for one thing, the people in the new field and the people in the old field always, of course, talked a different language.
Right.
And at that time, and you might also say that was the first time that the new, I think that's right, the first time in a long time that the new wavelength region was opened up.
Yeah.
And it was opened up by people who mostly were engineers,
right.
radar engineers from the war. They talked a rather different language. So the astronomers, in many cases, I think, simply didn't quite understand what they were talking about. And the astronomers themselves talk their own language, which is not so simple, which has lots of gobbledygook and
right.
expressions and things and so on, that do not help, certainly, to tend to communicate things to an engineering-type people. And I think it led to initially to not much communication, and it was only a few people, I think, in optical astronomy who saw across these these differences and realized the great basic interest of that. Jesse Greenstein, for instance, was immediately interested in radio astronomy.
Ort, of course,
and Minkowski too, and Bader. But many astronomers simply did not appreciate what was going on. I think that is very different these days. I mean.
Well, perhaps after radio had done this, then they were more willing to accept X-ray astronomy
and
so forth when they came along.
That's right. And these days, isn't that right? Well, if somebody talks a different language, you cross the barrier and try
to
find out what he was saying, and you yourself talk rather more clear about astronomy than you used to when you used all this astronomical terminology that is rather dense. So I think things have improved a lot. But in the beginning, yes, there was little communication, little understanding, I think. But because of Oort, in Holland, we didn't suffer
right,
from
that
this.
Was, and one exception.
Yeah, right. This work went on, and I think it was then in 1962 that